Taking Stock with Susan Hayes Culloden.
Brought to you by PwC.
This is News Talk.
Hello and welcome to Taking Stock. My name is Susan Hayes Culloden and this is the show that looks at business and economics from a wider perspective. Now, coming up on today's show, in a week where President Trump talks about a green scam and a report saying that peak oil demand isn't in sight, we ask if COP and the green energy movement is failing. The biggest companies in the world are spending eye-watering amounts on AI, but do they actually know what they're spending it on? We talked to the Financial Times dedicated AI reporter, plus this.
I don't understand what two traders are doing with a faithful.
They came after me, and it wasn't working. But no, one minute, it wasn't working. So then they came after Patrick and tried to recruit me because he had voted against me. And that's the only answer I can give to that. I mean, what else can I say? And I am a traitor.
Yes, it's the Irish TV event of the year, but just how much sponsorship and ad spend was generated by the traitors? We investigate. Now, you can email the show, takingstock@newstalk.com, or you can message me on socials at Susan Hayes Culloden. I'm going to start off this week by explaining to you what the term macro economics means, as it's often thrown into conversations that happen in the news. Now, the study of economics is broken into macro and microeconomics. Now, micro refers to the economics of the person, the household, the business, etc. But macro refers to the big stuff, like what's going on in the whole country, an entire industry, or how a whole population is changing with the trend. So that's typically where I'm going to focus here on Taking Stock. And now you know the distinction between how we might look at the individual in comparison to the aggregate. Now, according to the International Energy Agency, demand for fossil fuels may peak by the end of the decade, but the speed and the scale of this decline will determine whether we hit global climate targets or miss them badly. A new report suggests that under current policies, oil and gas use could actually keep rising all the way to 2050, putting the world on course for dangerous levels of warming. So what role should oil and gas companies play in the transition to clean energy, and how quickly can they change? We're joined now by Dr. Paul Dean, Senior Lecturer in Clean Energy Futures at University College Cork. Paul, if governments deliver in full on their national energy and climate pledges, the oil and gas demand would be 45% below today's level by 2050, and the temperature rise would be limited to 1.7 degrees Celsius, according to that report. How likely, though, is it that governments and countries are going to do that?
It's very unlikely for a number of reasons. We're just too slow at delivering the infrastructure that's required to facilitate that clean energy future. So the challenge really at a global level, and in many ways, Susan, it's reflected here in Ireland as well, is that we know pretty much what we have to do. So we're not kind of hostages to confusion here. We have the technologies, the finances there, but particularly in this part of the world, there's huge challenges in building out that infrastructure. We're very slow at building renewables, particularly here in Ireland, the wind and the solar is very, very slow. Places that tend to be leading the kind of the surge in clean energy at the moment are unusually places such as China. China, for example, have come in early for their renewable energy goals by about 6 years, which is phenomenal. Now, China, of course, has much lower levels of democracy than we have privileged over in this part of the world. So they're able to do things a lot quicker and maybe able to do things that we wouldn't be able to think about or even suggest here in Ireland. But the challenges really are about the deployment and the delivery of all these technologies. There's plenty of ambition out there. We've seen it this week at the in the UN. There's lots of pledges, but turning those pledges into action is a big challenge. And that seems to be one of the big, I suppose, really caveats when we think about that 1.5 degrees that we need to achieve from a climate perspective to avoid very dangerous warming in the future.
Well, I want to come back to the UN because there certainly was a character there who ruffled a few feathers, and we'll certainly get to that. But I do want to stick with China for a moment. You're absolutely right. China has invested more in clean energy than any other country around the world and is racing ahead. But is it also at the same time producing more emissions than any other part of the world as well because of the increase in manufacturing there?
Yes and no. So depending on who you chat to, Susan, China is either a climate hero or a climate villain. And look, to be honest, the truth is probably somewhere in the middle. China is delivering on huge levels of renewables. It's the largest builder of and developer of renewables in the world at the moment. But unfortunately, they're also building significant amounts of coal-fired power plant. Now, coal, from a global perspective, doesn't produce an awful lot of energy, but it does produce a huge amount of greenhouse gas pollution. And greenhouse gas pollution is the thing that you really want to reduce from a climate perspective. Now, why are China building coal? Well, they're building lots of coal, but they're probably going to be using those coal plants less and less. And what they are having challenges with is tightness in the electricity market. China, like many parts of the world, has seen growing electricity demand from growing economy, growing society. That's putting strain on the power system over there. And to meet that strain at times of the year when the sun isn't very, when the sun isn't shining a lot or it's not very windy, they tend to fall back into the use of coal. We kind of do the same thing here in Ireland to a smaller degree. Obviously, we tend to rely on natural gas rather than coal to fill in the gaps between the renewables. Now, the difference between coal and gas is that coal is much more polluting. Gas is still a fossil fuel, but it's the best of a bad lot. But China are making huge progress really on renewables, and really it's probably too early to say. They did increase their coal usage last year, just reflecting some of the weather instances that they have. But if China keep on doing what they're doing, I think the future could be very different to what we expect. There's a phrase that we use here in kind of in energy futures that when China changes, everything changes, and China has certainly changed dramatically in its outlook towards renewables in the last couple of years.
Bit of a difference too. When the US sneezes, the rest of us catch cold.
It is, you know, it's important to, I suppose, to understand the motivations for China to doing this. They're not virtue signaling to us as Westerners about climate change. They're not doing this to save the planet. They're doing this to save money. China have invested billions and huge amounts of capital in things like solar and wind and batteries and electric cars, and they see that as their manufacturing future. China is unusual, I suppose, from a global economy because they don't have significant amounts of oil or gas. They have coal, but coal is causing big challenges in China, particularly for the middle class and the society from an air pollution perspective. So I think China sees the future of energy in clean kit and in clean technology, and we're benefiting from that here in Ireland and in Europe. The price of solar panels, all these solar panels that we're seeing springing up around the country, are more than likely produced in China. They are significantly cheaper than what they were a number of years ago. And even though China is using a mix of coal and renewables to produce that kit, it's still an awful lot cleaner than what it was a number of years ago. And that brings us positive environmental benefits.
So now that we've looked, we'll say, at different parts of the world, I do just want to look at now companies that comprise the industry, because the oil and gas industry provides more than half of global energy supply and employs nearly 12 million workers worldwide. And, you know, some of those are earning quite significant wages. So as the net zero transition accelerates, like, companies in this industry are likely to get less profitable and it becomes a riskier business. And as I saw this pithy line in the report, transitions create powerful incentives to accelerate the pace of change while also draining a source of revenue that could finance it. So is there a massive disincentive for the oil and gas industry to get on board with the energy transition then, Paul?
There is, but I think it's important, Susan, to acknowledge that this energy transition will take time. We're not going to flick a switch over the next year or two and move away from fossil fuels. The sun will set on natural gas over the next 20 years, and for coal and for oil, it's probably 40 years. So that gives companies time to transition, time to think about new technologies. In the short term, we will need significant amounts of gas and oil. There's no getting away from that. You know, we need to heat our homes, we need to fuel our cars. So this transition will take time. So really, and the short-term outlook is very different to the long-term outlook. A lot of these companies now are taking a more short-term outlook. They're looking at existing gas and oil fields, trying to sweat those assets, trying to squeeze more, I suppose, hydrocarbons out of them. The investment, the longer-term investment in oil and gas is something that comes under a huge amount of uncertainty, because you have to put a huge amount of money on the table for an asset that needs to survive, let's say, 20 or 30 years to make its revenue return. So we are seeing a slight slowdown in some of those longer-term investments and more inward-looking in the current investments that they have at the moment.
Well, speaking of investments, if I go back there to the point you made about China, China's investing in clean energy because it saves money and it makes economic sense. I just want to take you through a little return on investment analysis here, right? So since 2018, the annual revenue generated by oil and gas has been about $3.5 trillion, and 40% of that went into investment in the industry. Now, in contrast, The oil and gas industry accounts for just 1% of total clean energy investment globally. Now, if you look at the return on investment, though, the return on capital employed in oil and gas has been about 6 to 9%, whereas only 6% for clean energy projects. And maybe your own analysis of this might give us a different number. But what does the world need to do, Paul, to make the numbers stack up so that the microeconomics of investing in clean energy, whether you're a company, a government or a consumer, improve?
Yeah, so oil and gas tend to thrive on uncertainty and volatility. We've seen that over the last 4 or 5 years, with the particularly with the invasion of Ukraine by Russia and the massive spike in profits that a lot of fossil fuel producers made around the world. So they tend to thrive on that uncertainty and that volatility, whereas renewables don't benefit from that. And actually what renewables offer the world is price stability and price certainty. And certainly the returns on those investments are lower, but the benefits for society are actually much, much higher. And this is probably one of those tensions that we have as we move away from fossil fuels. What governments can do and what governments need to do is to make, is to, I suppose, essentially grant the same level of policy support that they have granted fossil fuels over the last 70 to 100 years, to grant that now to renewables. And things that, you know, we are doing that to a certain extent. We're doing it here in Ireland. And what you're doing there is you're offering certainty that the electricity will be purchased, or the fuel will be purchased at a price that allows them to make a reasonable return. So in many ways, what the industry needs from, well, what the clean energy industry needs more than anything else is certainty, because the financing does stack up and the economics does stack up from a societal perspective and from a national perspective. But when you introduce uncertainty into the mix, that does erode the market case and the business case for developing renewables.
Okay, so it's not just about how much the return on investment is, but it's also the certainty or the consistency that it can be made.
Yeah, and that's very important, you know, and we've seen this actually with, you know, on the other side of this coin for oil and gas from the 2010 to 2018, when returns on investment were very, very low. You know, a lot of the oil majors really struggled to make any profits. But the oil and gas industry know that there is certainty to be eked out there somewhere, but that needs to be replicated really for renewables. And there are different market structures now coming into place in Ireland. We've got good contracts. We had an announcement by the minister this week on the procurement contracts for a certain level of renewables. Those contracts are what we call two-way contracts for difference. And essentially what they do, it's kind of a convoluted way really, but they offer price stability for renewable projects over a 15 or over 20 year period. And that stability is good for society, because if you're a business, you don't want to be exposed to the pricing volatility and the pricing exposure that fossil fuels bring. A lot of the businesses in Ireland and in Europe are suffering at the moment because the price of electricity is still very, very high. And that's primarily linked to the volatility that we've seen in natural gas prices. There are other elements coming in there, putting upward pressure on that as well. But the volatility in natural gas prices, which large fossil fuel companies tend to benefit from, we as a society and our businesses tend to suffer from.
Well, looking ahead into the very, very long term, we'll say like 15 and 20 years, and obviously the Earth is an old structure, so I know 15 to 20 years in the grand scheme of things isn't very long, but it certainly is much longer, let's say, than an earnings call quarter. But I listened to President Trump's United Nations address, where he called the whole climate change idea a hoax and a scam. But yet, as I was also looking at a study that came out this week about, like, drill, baby, drill, the impact of that, pushing prices down, I'm flying a kite. But is Trump a thinly veiled climate warrior, actually? Because by pushing the price of oil down to the point of where it doesn't make sense to drill more, is that actually inadvertently creating a disincentive to invest as well?
It is in many ways, you know, and I suppose, look, if we think back to President Trump's first presidency back in 2016, when coal was the big thing. But people forget that more coal-fired power plants shut down during his first 2 years of administration than the numbers that materialized during the Obama and Biden administration. So what President Trump has to deal with is pricing and physics. The physics of coal didn't stack in his favor, and it was a fuel that the industry didn't really want. and that didn't really stack up. The challenge with drill, baby, drill, and that mantra is that what oil companies want to do is make money. They don't necessarily want to drill; they want to make profit. And by flooding the market with excess volumes of oil, that might be good for consumers in terms of reducing the gas prices, as they say in the States, that they put into their cars and into their trucks and SUVs. But it significantly reduces the profit that oil majors make. So they want to make profit, and actually you can make a lot more profit by drilling less. And that's something, I suppose, really that President Trump has missed on that trick. And we haven't seen a major increase in drilling activity actually in the States over the last number of months. In fact, looking at the data for some of the shale plays in the Dakotas and some of those larger shale plays, their numbers are actually slowly declining at the moment. So it's the price that really matters for the oil majors rather than the slogans that are encouraging them to drill.
And that, I think, is going to be pivotal in the next couple of years about determining who is drilling. And of course, then the impact of that on who goes on to sell it. So if we were to look, let's look out a couple of years, I'm going to say 5 years here, and we look at where supply is coming from. If it was going to come from the place with a lower cost and we were going to buy it from there, it probably would be the Middle East. If countries were going to have a diversity of supply, it might come from all over the place. If it was to come from reducing emissions, well, then we might look at where energy, we'll say not just oil, but where energy is being produced the cleanest. If it was energy security, it might be in our own backyard in so much as possible. And if it was to foster economic development, well, then that would turn the economics again. So which of these, cost, diversity of supply, emissions, energy security, economic development, or others, do you think will take precedence, Paul? I know it's a big question.
Yeah, so if we break it down, technology by technology or fuel by fuel, I think, you know, China is holding all the cards in clean tech and green tech. You know, electric cars, batteries, solar panels, wind turbines, that is predominantly going to come from China over the next number of years. They have the minerals, they have the materials, they have the manufacturing, they have the clout. And what is winning there is economics. It's just more cost competitive now to generate a unit of electricity from wind and solar than it is from natural gas, than it is from oil. Certainly, you need to look at the storage issues, and that's where, you know, producing that unit of electricity when you need it and when you want it is a different thing that adds on to the cost. So in terms of green tech, I think it's certainly China. In terms of oil and gas, you probably have to differentiate there as well between the different fuels in the Middle East. The US can never compete with the low cost fuels for oil that's coming from the Middle East. But then you also have to think about how that oil is refined, the cost of transporting it around the world. But really for the US, the risk for them is a price risk. If the price of oil drops, or if the price of natural gas, now they're probably more exposed to oil than they are to natural gas, but if there's a low oil price over the next number of years, whether that's linked to a drop in economic activity around the world, where it's linked to a sudden rise in the electrification of transport, which again would kind of erode the volume base that some of the oil majors would need, well, then the price becomes an issue, because a lot of the oil wells and oil plays that exist in the US are predicated on and contingent on a pretty high oil price. So for President Trump, there's this tension. If you want the oil majors, keep those happy, you need a high price. If you want to keep drivers happy, you need a low price. And that price, you know, there's different anecdotal evidence and views out there. My view is that the President Trump and the American players need somewhere between $70 to $80 a barrel in terms of their break-even price. That's kind of similar to what it's a little bit higher than what it is today, but there's a tension really, I think, that will have to give in the future and it will probably break eventually.
There's so much more that I could have asked you about, Paul, whether it is where the future of this particularly lies in Europe, because we went around the world apart from that, and particularly battery storage. I'd have loved to talk to you more about that, but we'll have to leave it there. Thanks so much, Dr. Paul Dean, Senior Lecturer in Clean Energy Futures at University College Cork.
Thank you.
This is Susan Hayes Cullerton here on Taking Stock on News Talk. And after the break, we ask if companies actually know what they're doing with AI. Welcome back to Taking Stock. I'm Susan Hayes Cullerton. And now for our economic trivia. Well, I was in a county in Ireland this week. Okay, there's the first clue. Where we launched a Transition Your Work Experience programme in a county council. And this particular county has two pyramids, was home to the first ever All-Ireland final. And now this one should absolutely give it away. And it held Europe's largest outdoor agricultural trade show in the past month. Now, my two questions to you are, what is that trade show and what county was I in? Email me at takingstock@newstalk.com with your answer, and I'll also give you the answer to the trivia at the end of the show. Well, we all know that AI is the next great leap forward. It will change lives, aid productivity, and if you're a business, grow the bottom line. Well, that's the theory anyway, isn't it? Well, I came across a really interesting survey this week from the Financial Times that shows companies, particularly in the US, are questioning whether the capital spend on AI is really worth it. And to join me to talk about this is Melissa Haikala, the FT's AI correspondent, who joins me now. So first up, Melissa, big tech, including Meta and others, are planning to invest $300 billion this year alone in AI. But where exactly is that money going?
Well, mainly to them, actually. If you think about where that money is going, we're in this massive infrastructure boom, right? Tech companies are investing into data centers and models. But when you look at the broader landscape, for example, the biggest companies, listed companies in the US, it isn't quite clear whether they're seeing growth in this AI investment.
And this is the point, though, is when you say seeing growth, I'm coming back to the point of growth of what? I'm trying to figure out here. Is it that they're trying to develop, as you say, just infrastructure? Is it revenue streams? Is it profitability? Is it some sort of a unique selling point? I think over the years, we've been seeing a lot of money being pumped into this, but just like what's starting to happen now is the critical analysis may have been missing.
Well, exactly. And I mean, you know, this is a new technology. You know, ChatGPT only came into our knowledge in 2022, right? Late 2022. And since then, we've been experimenting with it and really trying to find use cases for this technology. And now, nearly 3 years later, that hasn't necessarily been the case, right? As anyone who uses these tools knows, AI tools are very expensive, and companies are wanting to see a return on this investment and wanting to see use cases that are actually reliable and work. And we're kind of hitting a sort of crunch point now.
Mm-hmm, exactly. Now, let's just delve right into what you've said, though, because, right, ChatGPT, many people who are listening to us today obviously will be aware of what that is, but primarily that's under the realm, we'll say, of generative AI, where I ask ChatGPT a question and it can now give me text, it can give me a picture, it can give me other different things. And if we look around the AI world at the moment, we know that AI is useful for customer service. We know it's helpful in making decisions because it can analyse vast amounts of data. We know it can help speeding processes up. And also, like you were saying there, in terms of generative AI, it can write and generate things. But beyond that, I found it interesting in a piece you wrote this week, you said that the anticipated benefits of AI is far more vague and harder to categorise than the risks. Can you tell us a little bit more about what you mean by that?
Absolutely. So with my colleagues, we wanted to do a very thorough and data-led analysis of what companies are actually seeing or talking about when they talk about AI. And so we did an analysis, this vast analysis of company reports and earning reports of S&P 500 companies. And there we saw this massive difference. When you look at the earnings reports, CEOs would often rave about the technology, make massive promises about this is going to boost our productivity, lead to an explosion of innovation, you know, things like that. But when you look at their annual reports and their regulatory filings, the picture is far more sober. So companies would often highlight things like risk, cybersecurity, often a fear of missing out, that if they don't do it, some of their competitors will and they would lose, or fear of being sued because of this new technology. But no one could really illustrate or verbalize exactly how they're using it. I mean, there were vague promises of productivity again, but the risks were far clearer to these companies than the benefits.
I'm often on those calls, a range of them over the past earnings season and beyond, and I'm always watching out for what companies are investing in when it comes to AI. And the two things you said there, you said one is the fear of being sued and the other one is the fear of basically a competitor getting ahead first. And this is what I'm trying to figure out here, is ahead of what? Is it at the moment that it has been pouring in money and one party is spending more than another? Or is it actually really solving a problem? It's interesting also as well, though, that you say that they're vague about what they're getting out of them. Do you think, is that because on an earnings call, the job of the company is to say, here's what we're doing, here's how we're doing great, here's why obviously you should continue to invest, and therefore they have to keep coy?
I mean, 100%. I mean, a big part of it is also that the tech sector has been masterful in selling us this promise of this technology that'll change everything. And anyone who doesn't use it is a loser.
But it kind of has changed everything though, hasn't it?
Well, I guess it depends in what way, right? Like, yes, we do interact with the internet in a new way, and we have these new tools. But if you think about the day-to-day of how companies operate, these tools aren't, say, as useful or reliable as some other tools we use.
Okay. Well, in terms of the capital outlay, I saw another piece that was actually on the FT that referenced your own, Melissa, and it quoted a study from Bain, and these numbers are frightening. Bain put some numbers on this. They said that AI companies need to spend $500 billion on capital investment each year to meet demand by 2030, right? So, okay, we could say, right, there is demand there. However, that requires $2 trillion of revenues in order to have enough left over to invest in the capital. And the industry is likely to miss this by $800 billion. So, Melissa, are all the companies working practically in silos and yet the industry hasn't got the room for them all?
I mean, it does kind of look like that. The number, when you think about these numbers critically, they don't really make sense. And they're all kind of based on these promises. And it's unclear whether AI companies will be able to deliver on them.
Right. And I was looking there in particular, I'm sure you saw during the week about NVIDIA promising to invest $100 billion in OpenAI. And again, I went interrogating, like, what exactly is that going to be in? It's back to the point you made earlier about data infrastructure. And it looks like that in order to consume, or in order to be able to deliver the infrastructure, of course, it needs a massive, massive, massive amount of energy. Do you think the industry can absorb the money that these companies are getting ready to invest?
It's all sort of, like, the numbers don't make sense. They're so big, right? And yes, the problem here is that we still need to build these data centers. They're at least a few years out. We don't have the energy infrastructure to fund or, like, power these power stations or data centers. So that's a big unsolved question. I guess we're about to find out whether, if you just say you're going to pour all this money into that, whether that'll lead to anything meaningful.
Exactly. And that's what'll be very interesting to watch. I also wanted to pick up here on a quote that you mentioned in your own piece. You quoted Aditya Chalapalli at the MIT Media Lab, who said, when we spoke to executives, and they were talking about AI infrastructure and AI changes that were made in those companies, when we spoke to executives, they would often say the internal tool was very successful. But when we spoke to employees, we found zero usage. What does that tell you?
That CEOs are under immense pressure to show that they're doing something, but that these AI tools or the current capabilities aren't maybe up to scratch. You know, this researcher also said that a big reason for that is that these models lack features such as long-term memory or customization, which would make them easier to plug into existing systems. And a lot of companies also don't have the data to enable the use of these AI systems. And so, you know, you might create an AI chatbot for your organization that looks really magical and nice, but whether that's actually useful for your employees or customers, that's the big question.
And that is the big question, isn't it? Because I can completely see where executives are bringing these new technologies into the business, saying this is going to, just like you say, dramatically change productivity. And yet when it comes down to it, though, it's the change management of people who are using them. You're asking people to change behavior.
Well, exactly. And that's where it should all come down to, really. We need to be thinking about this AI transition, not just as, like, let's throw AI at everything and hope we find a use case, but thinking about what problems we have and how this technology can help us solve them. And then we need to change include the entire organization, every process in that change, and have employees, you know, empowered in that change to actually create useful technology.
Well, in your role as the Financial Times AI correspondent, Melissa, as you've been looking at the area of AI in general, how would you answer that first question? Like, what problems do we have that AI can help with?
AI is a fantastic technology, and we've seen some amazing use cases. For example, in science, AI companies have used these tools to predict extreme weather events way sooner and way quicker. More accurately than our current methods, which is huge, right? Especially in a warming planet. AI has also been used to predict really hard or solve really hard problems in biology, such as how proteins fold. And this could be really useful in creating new drugs. And so I mean, those are amazing use cases. And I think that's what the problem with AI, it's really, really powerful in these very specific problems. But when you try to throw it at every problem in the world, that's often when we see these failures.
Exactly. And I thought it was interesting as well how you noted that you can't replicate a problem if it happens because you don't know how AI is generating the outcome in the first place. As you were saying in the piece, and I recommend anybody to read it, in the piece you were highlighting how companies aren't comfortable with the fact that they don't 100% understand how AI works themselves in the first place.
Yeah, I mean, exactly. I mean, when you think about the main things they did mention in our analysis, cybersecurity was one major one, but also a fear of reputational risks and the technology just failing, which could have big repercussions for companies.
Can I pick up on that a bit more, though? Because you mentioned how the most commonly cited concern was cybersecurity. You said it was mentioned by more than half of the S&P 500 companies in their earnings calls in 2024. What particularly are they worried about?
Well, AI tools can be used to conduct more powerful cyber attacks. For example, they could be really powerful tools in creating malware. And that just scales up the amount of attacks companies face. But also, just by using these tools, you are exposing yourself to new kinds of security risks because these models have these security flaws that aren't solved yet. And could lead to sensitive customer information, for example, leaking out.
Also, as well, what about the fact that the sheer amounts of data that are being used to train these models may be coming from copyrighted material, or is there legal or regulatory challenges that companies might be facing that really they never faced before and potentially they didn't intend to?
I mean, 100%. This is one of the biggest fights in AI right now. Who's allowed to use what data, and whether content creators and copyright holders should be compensated for having their content used in AI training data. AI companies say that anything on the free internet is free to use. Obviously, copyright holders disagree. And, you know, it's not just about who's right and wrong. It's kind of about the whole financial and funding model of these AI companies, right? They have to pay for their training data, which is the intelligence in their models. That could really, really, well, harm their margins massively.
Well, I just want to ask you one last question. And I want to move away from margins and the finance for a moment, because I don't know if it would appear for everyone, but at the bottom of the page on the FT, now I was reading it digitally, there was an FT drama. And on this, there was, and I hadn't seen an FT drama before. I've seen certainly plenty of Financial Times documentaries, but on this, there was a scenario in this drama where a daughter was using an AI program to retrieve her dad's memories who had dementia. Now, I won't spoil the ending for anyone who wants to watch it, but it did bring up, Melissa, what can happen with hallucinations. And hallucinations, for anyone who isn't familiar with the term when it comes to AI, it means AI coming up with things that don't exist at all. And do you think that companies and the industry at large has an awareness that there's big social implications of whether it's generating information that doesn't really that isn't true, or just the role that AI can play in distorting reality sometimes?
I really hope so. I mean, I feel like we've seen enough cases of companies getting into real trouble because of hallucinations. We've seen customer service chatbots promise policies that don't exist and then companies having to honor them. So I would really suggest anyone using these tools to really educate themselves about how these models can fail and how they function and how hallucinations can creep up. And so on one hand, yes, perhaps there is more awareness. But on the other hand, you know, as we interact with these models, people are using them increasingly as therapists or companions. And I get it. They're very empathetic and personable. And we maybe have a tendency to place human-like characteristics in these models and maybe trust them more than we should. And that could have big consequences for our perception of reality.
Well, Melissa, as the Financial Times AI correspondent, you are going to have a fascinating job in these coming years. Thank you so much for joining me here on Taking Stock. Melissa Heikela, the FT's AI correspondent.
Thank you so much.
This is Susan Hayes Cullerton here on Taking Stock on News Talk. And after the break, we look at the sponsorship money made by the traitors. Now, you're welcome back to Taking Stock here on News Talk. I'm Susan Hayes Cullerton. Well, it brought back the power of appointment TV. The 12-episode running in blocks of three over four successive weeks were a runaway ratings-busting winner. The Traitors conquered all before it. Rating success means advertisers would be anxious to have their products associated with it. But how was that decided? And what do companies want when they enter into a sponsorship deal? So I'm delighted to be joined by Jill Downey here in studio, the Managing Director of Core Sponsorship, who had the foresight to secure sponsorship of the show for their clients Very. So first up, Jill, how did you at Core look at how the programme was being sold?
Well, the first thing was that RTÉ actually put it out to the market. So that's how they would treat most opportunities. So they sent out a flyer, for want of a better word, with all the details of the programme coming up and the opportunities within it. Now, with every programme of appointment view kind of status, there would be spot advertising that advertisers would look at. But when it comes to sponsorship, there's usually a main sponsor of the show and they'll get the stings, they're called. That's basically the last message before the programme starts, and then it's top and tail of the ad break. So they would usually get the stings and then any other associated assets that come with the extension of the programme kind of beyond the TV estate. So that would be onto video on demand on RTÉ Player, for example. In this case, there was an Uncloaked or companion show, which was great and added more value. But that would have all that detail would have come out in the bidding process, I suppose, and the information that RTÉ sent us. So in this case, though, there was a bid system. So that's not always the case. So RTÉ would send out opportunities, as do any of the media houses out there. And you would you would get that on a first-come, first-served basis normally. In this case, they were looking for bids because they knew it would be of great value.
So in that case, did you, on behalf of your clients or your clients, have to say directly how much they were willing to put forward? Is that what you mean by a bid, almost like an auction?
Yeah, it's. I suppose you put in an offer, and usually the highest offer will win in that case. So that's it's unusual. It would have to be a pretty special program, and in this case, it obviously was.
Well, let's look at just how special. So across the 12 episodes, the series pulled in an average of 557,000 live and viewed on the same day. And there was a 50% share of viewing. And on the RTÉ Player, it has been streamed 3.7 million times. But of course, Jill, you needed to make this bid before any of that happened. So how did you decide that this was what you wanted to go for?
It's a great question. At the moment, I suppose the really key appointment to view programmes tend to be live sport. And there hasn't been anything for quite a while that would really captivate the nation in this manner. And I had been familiar with the Traitors concept from other markets. It was starting to gain real traction in the UK. So what you saw, I was typically going on the information I could find. And what was really interesting was that the applications for the third series in the UK had tipped 250,000 people, which is a phenomenal.
Applying to participate.
Applying to
go into the castle.
Yeah. So I knew that it was building massive scale there. I had also talked to the production company Kite Entertainment, who were bringing it to market. They were very excited about it. So when RTÉ first sent out the information around the programme and the process, we just knew ourselves instinctively in Core that this was going to be really exciting. It was a risk, obviously, because there's always a risk with programming adapted from other markets. We wouldn't always have the greatest reputation from adapting them in the best possible way. Sometimes the production quality can be quite low. But I knew with Kite Entertainment behind it, it was going to be special. So that was the first. They hadn't even decided where it was going to be shot, anything else at this stage. So yes, it was a little bit of a risk in a way, but we literally haven't had a program like this come to TV for quite a while, real appointment to view program, and so we felt that it can't always be about sport, and that there are plenty of brands out there looking for other entertainment vehicles to sponsor.
Speaking of, when it comes to Very, the brand itself, what made it want the Traitors?
Yeah, that's again a really interesting question. So from Very's perspective, they're coming into a really key sales period for them. So obviously pre-Christmas is really, really important. They were also completely relaunching their own Very brand, their own brand clothing label as well. And they are, as a brand, people are still getting used to Very. It had been Littlewoods for a number of years. So they still had a job to do in sort of bringing Very to the masses.
Brand awareness.
Brand awareness, yeah, mm-hmm. exactly. And a show of this nature, and obviously we were endorsing it because we very much believed in it. And again, they took a leap of faith, I suppose, as well with us. But they would have really felt that it was good timing from the perspective of getting a prime asset like that pre their important pre-Christmas sales period. So it's sort of primed people to understand who Very are now. And then as they go into that sort of marquee shopping period, they are already aware of Very, and they've seen great impact already.
Well, I did want to ask about that, because for the first 9 episodes, consolidated ratings rose by an average of 140,000 viewers per episode. So when it comes back to talking about impact or return on investment, and apologies to ask such a crass question, but it's important that we understand that. Is this what a client like Very wants to see? Is it about number of people watching, or is it engagement with a brand? Does it ultimately turn into revenue? What makes them be delighted with what you've done, Jill?
It's a number of factors, really. The eyeballs are really important, though. You know, I mean, that's effectively what you're paying for. In the Very deal, there's a number of assets. The Stings are only one of those assets, but they are the ones that carry the most value. So the more people watch, is the more valuable those ratings or those Stings are. How many people were watching was really important. And we had been predicting around 500,000. So we were not far off.
Very close, figures. Yeah.
But actually, I mean, I think the first episode was around 470 overnight. And that consolidated to over 700,000 now. That's phenomenal updated viewing, if you know what I mean. So it's very rare that you see the numbers go up so high a couple of days later. But what happened was it had a great start. So it was, coming in around what we were predicting. And then anyone who wasn't seeing it was hearing about it. So they all went back to watch the first episode, those who hadn't actually watched it live. And that made the numbers jump up.
Well, I was out for dinner last Friday night with my brother and his girlfriend, who were telling me they were obsessed with it. And as I went up to pay the bill, I just mentioned it to the person who was serving us in the restaurant, who also told me that she was obsessed with it. So if you weren't watching it, you had no choice but to talk about it anyway. Yeah. And I do want to ask you about another unique characteristic about this, because it has been described as an intergenerational appointment view phenomenon. What was that, or what is the role of that intergenerational transfer? Like the fact that mams and dads could watch it with their teenagers who were watching it with their grannies. Like this, it really seemed to capture the nation's interest.
Yeah, and I don't think it's by design necessarily that it was interesting for kids, but my kids were obsessed with it as well.
And obsessed seems to be the word that keeps coming up here. Yeah.
And actually I think, the format of the show is a really good lesson for teenagers, that everything isn't what it seems, and you can read into things that aren't there. And that was certainly the message I was giving to my daughter. But it is amazing. It's the format of the show really that has made that work. It's the interest we have in people. But I also think that if you compare our version to the UK or the US version, which are very good, very entertaining as well, the Irish personality actually really works.
Oh,
in
absolutely.
Show.
It was really quintessentially Irish. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So I think that's what really has worked. And I think that's just the intrigue we have in watching people. And when the viewer knows what's going on, but the contestants don't, it's really interesting to see how they pick up on the different cues and things like that. So that's what makes it really entertaining. It's a really incredible format. So whoever came up with this, it's a Dutch format originally. It's just a really smart thing. I think the other reason why kids are, teenagers and things know it or like it is because it has quite similar characteristics to the Among Us game and a few other games that they would be used to playing themselves. So they kind of get it. And then watching it, apart from a bit of cursing in it, really. There's no, you know, there's no gratuitous of a gratuity in any way, really. It's not like Love Island, where you would be worried about what they're watching and the sort of messaging it sent to them. It's, I think it's actually, there's quite a good message behind it. So I think that's why it works.
And the couple of Fuckle as well, yeah. Of course, yeah. There was that too.
Thrown in was very important. Yeah.
Can I also ask you about the other two brands, Mercedes and Musgraves? What was in it for them?
So they are product placement deals. Essentially, the best thing you can do with a product placement deal is to make sure it's seamlessly woven into a show and it doesn't feel forced and it doesn't feel like you're trying to sell at the consumer or the viewer in this case. The car is a very central part of the show anyway. Mm-hmm. So what was in it for them really is to have their product seen and part of a cultural conversation. That's the same for Very as well. You asked earlier if it was, you know, eyeballs or, you know, viewership was really important. But yeah, being part of the conversation that's going on, being able to insert your brand into that kind of conversation is really hard to do and really valuable for a brand. So I think the natural place for the car within the gameplay and the tasks in the show just made it a really great opportunity for Mercedes-Benz. And the car looked fantastic in it. You mm-hmm. know, I think the setting of Slane really helped. It was a brave move for them as well. I think the other really important thing to mention is that while the numbers you've already read out are very big numbers, if you look at the numbers of 25 to 44 year old adults watching, the share for that is up around 80%.
That's unheard of, isn't it?
Practically unheard of.
And particularly on a flat screen at a point in time.
Yeah, it is incredible to think that many people are like, now I'm wondering what were the other 20% watching? And I'll actually have to go back and do the analysis on that. But, you know, that's a huge, huge share and huge share for RT1 in particular.
But also, of course, The Traitors was on before primetime. Yes. Like primetime was moved in order to facilitate The Traitors. Whoever got that over the line, how did they manage that?
Again, the whole of RT were behind this program and behind making it a success. So I think they all worked together. But just on that 25 to 44 year old audience, they're hard to reach typically. And for the likes of Mercedes and Sentra, being able to talk to them and be culturally relevant to them is a great opportunity. And, you know, you don't get that often.
Can I also ask, when it comes to, I'm not just talking about that demographic, but the character watching the television now typically has a second screen at the same time, namely a mobile device. But also, of course, they don't necessarily like watching TV at a certain time. It's not like Glen Rowe at 8:30 on a Sunday night before, Jill.
Yeah, do you have your essay done?
Exactly. So they typically want to maybe fast forward through the ads, or also, of course, they could be looking at something on the TV that is not television. It could be YouTube, it could be Netflix, etc. So when it comes to you positioning brands, how are you thinking about, or have you adapted to that type of audience with that type of behaviour today?
Well, I think you've hit on something really important here, and another reason why it's such a valuable asset, I suppose, for the sponsors and partners is that if you're within the content of the show, and again, if it's seamlessly done as opposed to being in your face, you're where they're most attentive, you know. So during between the breaks, when the program is on air, that's when you have people's main attention, and particularly in a gameplay type of show, so they're watching
and talking about it.
Yeah, mm-hmm. You'd miss a lot if you're not watching kind of live. So despite maybe the odd WhatsApp message to your family to say, I knew it was him, or the
party for president,
etc. They're generally paying attention. So higher attention is what all advertisers are looking for, you know, to be able to place your brand within really high attentive moments. That's really key. So that's really what was in it for them as well. And then outside of that, we were able to extend the reach of the product placement deals by being able to activate through social media. And activating a sponsorship is really important as well. So, you know, you can't just rely on the program itself. You want to extend your reach into other areas. So you had Mercedes-Benz and Sentra doing brilliant activation videos and social media campaigns that really supported and lifted their awareness of their association with the show as well.
Well, Jill, you certainly know what you're doing, and it'll be interesting to see what happens when season two, if and when it comes out, see who has got the sting, etc. at that stage. Thanks so much, Jill Downey, Managing Director of Core Sponsorship, who's joined me today in studio.
Thank you.
Now, here are the answers to my trivia questions. So I told you earlier on in the show that I was in a particular county. I said I was at a county council this week to launch a Transition Your Work Experience programme, and I asked you two questions. I said, what was the county and what was the trade show? And to give you the detail on this, so this particular county, it has two pyramids, was home to the first ever All-Ireland final, and it held Europe's largest outdoor agricultural trade show in the past month. Now, the answers are, the trade show, of course, was the National Ploughing Championships, and the county is Offaly. It has a pyramid in Lough Burra Discovery Park and another one in Kinnity. The first ever All-Ireland final was played in Birr, and the ploughing, of course, was held this month in Tullamore. So that's it for this week's Taking Stock with me, Susan Hayes Cullerton. I hope you enjoyed the show and possibly even learned something about economics and how it affects our world. Now, I will just remind you, this show is available as a podcast first on Friday mornings on the News Talk app or wherever you go to get your podcasts, and make sure to subscribe to us while you're there. It's also on the radio every Sunday morning at 9 a.m. The producer of Taking Stock this week was John Fardy, and on research was Stephen Daunt and Simon Keane. Hugo De Silva Scott was on sound. Thanks so much for listening, and enjoy the rest of your day, and I look forward to chatting to you again next week.